This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, as U.S. President Barack Obama passes the baton to Donald J. Trump, we look back at the legacy of America's first black president. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. The son of a Caucasian mother and Kenyan father, the junior senator from Illinois mesmerized citizens, both Democratic and some Republicans, to capture the White House, first in 2008 and then in 2012. Some analysts say the Obama administration's greatest achievement was in its first year, stabilizing a collapsing economy and arguably avoiding a second Great Depression. In addition, some senior former administration officials assert that Mr. Obama wound down wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, averted the prospect of a dangerous confrontation with Iran by reaching a multilateral nuclear agreement, put in place a counterterrorism strategy, negotiated groundbreaking nonproliferation and climate agreements, provided humanitarian aid and fought Ebola and AIDS, rebalanced attention and military resources to Asia, and reestablished diplomatic relations with Cuba. Oh, he also killed Osama bin Laden. Critics say he left a more destabilized world by not acting more aggressively to help the Syrian opposition defend itself from the depredations of the Syrian regime, by not enforcing the Red Line Statement at a minimum. He helped to fuel the largest refugee crisis since World War II. At the end of his term, some analysts say that our enemies do not fear us and our friends don't think we have their back. Well, for more on the positive and negative aspects of President Obama's domestic and international legacy, we turn to two distinguished foreign policy scholars. Hella Dale is Senior Fellow in Diplomacy Studies at the Heritage Foundation, that's a think tank here in Washington, and Ken Goode, he's Senior Fellow with the National Security Team at the Center for American Progress, a think tank also based in Washington. Hella Dale joins us by phone. Hella, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
And Ken Goode joins me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you.
Thanks, Carol. Delighted to be here.
Hella Dale, first let me begin with you. Let me get your take on President Obama's legacy. Of course, it's early days. We don't really know the full impact of a leader's legacy for many years. Nonetheless, we can still talk about how President Obama will be remembered for both his domestic and international achievements or even setbacks.
Well, thank you for that important question, because in our discussion today, we are in fact helping to shape the historical thinking on that legacy. In my view, President Obama's instinct to reduce the American footprint in the world and to show restraint in foreign policy that would then, as he hoped, would encourage other leaders around the world to step up to solve global problems and take more responsibility, and taking a very long view of history, trusting to some extent that all would be well in the end, has unfortunately in the short and middle term resulted in a more chaotic and dangerous world. And in my view, whether we're looking at the Middle East or at China's actions in the South China Sea, or the disarray in the European Union under pressure from immigrants from the Middle East, we are looking at an Obama legacy which will be detrimental to his reputation and which will reflect growing American weakness in the world.
Turning to you here in the studio, Ken Goode, for your initial take on President Obama's legacy.
Thanks, Carol. I don't think it's going to come as a great surprise that I don't share exactly in Hella's view of the Obama legacy. Like, I think there's a lot of amnesia about the state of the world that President Obama inherited in January of 2009. The United States at that point wasn't in decline, it was in freefall. The world economy was on the verge of collapse. The U.S. economy shed nearly a million jobs in January. We had tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of U.S. soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan fighting in harm's way. The standing of the United States was completely in the gutter. We had a very confrontational relationship with our allies, not only over the wars, but over the conduct of the way we treated detainees, the way we treated prisoners at Guantanamo and at black sites around the world. And President Obama came into office and very quickly righted that ship. He restored and stabilized the world and U.S. economy. We've had 75 consecutive months of job growth here in the United States, and unemployment is at about 5%. There's a lot more to do on the economy, but that was an incredible achievement. We've wound down the wars. I think certainly many people, myself included, would have liked to have seen more progress on that. But I think when you look at how the president handled the potential for military engagement or issues that would have come to military engagement in the past, and the contrast between how the president handled a real nuclear program in Iran versus how his predecessor, President Bush, handled what turned out to be not a nuclear program in Iraq, where we have a verifiable multilateral deal to restrict and eliminate Iran's nuclear program. And Iran now is farther away from a nuclear weapon than Iraq is, and they didn't even have a nuclear program. So it seems to me that when we look back at how President Obama has handled his presidency, history will look very kindly on it.
Well, back to you, Hella Dale, to continue on this conversation. There's no question President Obama came into office to some extent on a platform of being the anti-Bush, where he was trying to be more restrained, where President Bush was perhaps overactive, whether it was the U.S.-led invasion in Iraq, coming out actually of Afghanistan and turning attention to Iraq. On the other hand, as you have said, he perhaps retreated too much. Given these tensions, what else do you think he could or should have done, given the fact that he did come in on that platform of pulling back and winding down the wars?
Well, he came in on that platform in part because that was the platform that he stated that he stood for, and I think he genuinely did. I think as a foreign policy thinker and a politician, his inclination has always been to consider the United States' role in the world, maybe even the role of the West in the world, to have been too great and in need of restraint. But I honestly think that we are not left any safer for having taken that road. And I think President Obama, to some extent, was guilty of believing his own media. I mean, the media is just about 100% polar opposite from where it is today. It was fawning over the new president who could do absolutely no wrong. And if you remember, he even received a Nobel Peace Prize before he'd even done anything whatsoever, just by virtue of being who he was. So the expectations were sky high, and I think President Obama believed them. If you look at his foreign policy speeches, he was promising peace in the Middle East, friendship with the Muslim world, reach out to Asia. I mean, his themes were so grand, you know, we were going to do away with nuclear weapons, that it seemed sometimes that he wanted to conduct foreign policy mainly by rhetoric, not by realistic rhetorical powers and his own powers as a person. And that had to fall short. There is no doubt about that. That is not in itself enough to conduct a foreign policy. I also just want to say that I think actually, disparaged as the Bush administration was in many quarters, its relationship with our allies, particularly our European allies, was in many ways better. It was more realistic and it was more based on more on fact than imagination and dreams. The Europeans for a long time were not even able to figure out who they were supposed to deal with in the Obama administration, who very quickly turned away from them towards Asia, towards the Middle East. At the same time, have a belief that the U.S. presence in the world did need to be curtailed because it was harmful.
I'd like to get Ken Gu to weigh in on that. Ken, some points that Hella made are quite interesting with regard to his soaring rhetoric, that is, President Obama perhaps not being able to live up to the rhetoric, whether the speech he made in Cairo to the Muslim world and then the Arab Spring followed. And many people in the Arab world were very disappointed because he didn't really follow through. His turning toward Asia, the so-called pivot, the rebalance toward Asia, a very good idea on the face of it and given aggressions by China. On the other hand, the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal didn't really materialize. How do you account for these discrepancies? How do you reconcile the rhetoric and the actions, or lack thereof?
Well, I think there's can be no doubt that President Obama is a terrific orator who is capable of delivering a speech that swells emotions inside of the people who are listening to it. But I think it's a mistake to say that he was all rhetoric and no action. And I take a different view than Hella at how President Obama and the Obama administration views the world. It is not that American engagement in the world has been harmful and that what we need to do is show restraint. That isn't their approach at all. I think what they have done is recognized that we don't have a magic wand that can just erase away the challenges that emerged for the United States global leadership following the dual crises of the Iraq War catastrophe and the global financial crisis. And that in the wake of those examples, we had other countries who were rising powers in their own right begin to assert themselves on the international scene in ways that the United States hadn't seen since the end of the Cold War. And as a consequence of that, the United States needed to shift the manner in which it engaged with other countries, whether they're allies and partners or potential adversaries like China. And what we see from the Obama administration is a consistent building up of international agreements that have achieved the goals that it has set out for. It has worked towards a truly global climate deal and also engaged in a bilateral deal with China. It identified very early on that nuclear proliferation was a serious concern. It agreed a new arms reduction treaty with the Russians in a bilateral way and worked multilaterally with P5+1 to secure a deal with the Iranians to restrict and eliminate their nuclear capabilities. So I don't think the Obama administration has retreated from the world in any way, unless what is your measurement for U.S. engagement or non-retreat is that we invade other countries. And that hasn't occurred during the Obama administration. And yes, I think when you look at the Syria conflict, it is a horrible tragedy. But I have yet to hear any reasonable argument to be made why a substantial military engagement by the United States in Syria would have ended up any better for us than Iraq.
You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Hella Dale, she's Senior Fellow in Public Diplomacy Studies at the Heritage Foundation, and Ken Good, from whom you just heard, he's Senior Fellow with the National Security Team at the Center for American Progress. We're discussing President Obama's legacy after his 8 years in the White House. And do you know that this is only the second time in U.S. history that we have had three consecutive two-term presidents? First, Bill Clinton, then George W. Bush, and of course, Barack Obama. The first time was Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, and James Monroe. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Vyacheslav Lavrinov from Sukhinichi, Russia. If you want to hear your name on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, Hella Dale, back to you. We're not going to solve this very real dispute over the Syrian conflict. Should the United States have gotten more involved or less? To what extent that would have had an impact on the terrible outcome, the fact that the Russians went in 2015. So let's move on now to some other impediments, perhaps, for Mr. Obama throughout his term. There were tensions with the predominantly Republican Congress. We recall Senator Mitch McConnell saying we wanted to make President Obama a one-term president. To what extent do you think this attitude on behalf of the Republicans perhaps hindered Mr. Obama from reaching greater common ground on contentious but important issues such as health care or immigration reform, even gun safety, or even on the international stage?
I think it is probably the purpose of every political party in opposition to win the next election. Don't you think so? So I don't think Mr. McConnell's statement is way out of line. I think we have to recall that the Republicans and the Democrats do have political and ideological differences, which are genuine and deep, and which you can expect them to act on both sides. You should also remember that President Obama, once he came into office, came in with a pretty high-handed attitude of his own. I would like to quote Mr. Obama, who at one point said to the Republicans in a speech, "We won, you lost, get used to it." There is no doubt that Washington is polarized, but the fault is certainly on both sides, not just on one. And one thing that President Obama did not like to do, and almost never did during his two terms in office, was to actually reach out to Congress to spend time with both parties in Congress. He is not, according to his own advisors, a people person. And dealing with congressional leaders of both parties takes a lot of glad handling. It takes a lot of diplomatic skill and a lot of personal self-confidence, I guess. So I think there was a problem on both sides. And it's true that Washington did not work particularly well in these last 8 years. but the constant pointing as the Republicans as the only ones who were at fault for this, I do not believe is true. There are equal power centers in Washington, the presidency, Congress, and the Supreme Court. And according to the U.S. Constitution, they have to be able to function together. Then one of them is not the sole point of power. And in Obama's second term, we found that he was basically ruling by decree. In fact,
executive orders.
And that is now a problem for him because it allows the incoming administration to nullify a lot of what he put in place in his second term.
But Hallidale, quickly before I turn to Ken Goode, do you think there was a catch-22? Do you think the fact that he issued executive orders as opposed to legislation was because he felt stymied by so much opposition on the Republican side? If he had his druthers, he would have preferred legislation, but he felt stymied, and therefore that's why he used executive orders.
Well, I think that's undoubtedly true, but it is, according to the U.S. Constitution, Congress that writes the laws, not the president.
Let me turn to Ken Goode for your take, Ken. To what extent the predominantly Republican Congress in the last 6 years of President Obama's two terms maybe stymied him in a number of areas, whether on the domestic side, healthcare, even though we got the so-called Obamacare passed, but now we look at a possibility of it being repealed. Immigration reform didn't go anywhere, gun safety regulations, and so forth.
There's no question that politics is a rough business. We have a saying here in the United States that politics ain't beanbag. And political leaders of both parties have traditionally and currently engaged in hard-nosed fighting over their policies and their priorities. But I think what we saw from Republicans in 2009 and 2010 was a departure from the norms in which those political fights are engaged. 2006 was a pretty substantial wave election on the part of Democrats sweeping into control of the Congress. And then obviously, President Obama won and Democrats won huge majorities in the House and the Senate. And at the time, we were facing this grave crisis of the global financial meltdown and our economy was in free fall. And President Obama, I think, went very far in trying to win the support of Republicans in Congress for a package to rectify that. And let's be clear, going back in history, when we faced grave economic crises like that, there is a tradition of the parties coming together and putting aside political squabbles and working towards the good of the country. And we didn't see that in early 2009. And this notion that all President Obama needed to do was do some more schmoozing and have some cocktail parties with Republicans and everything would have been fine, I think doesn't really pass the laugh test, because these Republicans were acting on their raw political interests, and those interests were fueled not by the fact that they didn't have a lot of face time with President Obama, because let's recall, in the spring of 2009, Republicans in the House invited President Obama to their retreat, and he stood in front of all Republican House members and had an open session where they could ask him questions. It was televised on national TV and gave them an opportunity to ask him any question that he wanted, and he answered them to the best of his ability. So, I don't think that there was a lack of engagement from the White House to Republicans in Congress. The hand that they put out was slapped back. President Obama's signature achievement, Obamacare, basically was derived from a plan that was created at the Heritage Foundation in the 1990s. And yes, that was a different time than 2009 and 2010. But the key piece of contention in the early part of the debate around health care was the individual mandate. The individual mandate came out of that plan that Heritage developed. It also was part of the Romney health care plan in Massachusetts. But not only that, Senator Grassley introduced a bill in the spring of 2009 that included an individual mandate. So it wasn't as if this wasn't a part of the Republican health care policy thinking at the time the bill was debated. And all of a sudden, the individual mandate became the gravest threat to the Constitution that we've ever seen. And that's the departure that I think we saw in the early part of the Obama administration that can't simply be explained away by the normal political back and forth that always exists and always has existed and probably always will.
Back to you, Hella Dale. And
I think I need to respond to that, given that I am actually employed by the Heritage Foundation, did indeed put out years ago a plan that included an individual mandate. That was since revised and changed and not part of Heritage policy by the time the Obamacare legislation passed. Also, it is an indisputable fact that the Obamacare included a lot of other provisions which have since been immensely controversial.
All right. In the very few minutes we have left, Hallidale, with respect to Obamacare, it looks like the new administration is on its way to repeal it anyway. So we will see to what extent the health care law will even remain in any recognizable form. But going forward, I want to pick up on something you said earlier in the program, Hella, which is that President Obama, in your view, was not as supportive enough of perhaps our EU allies. But as we go forward, what we're hearing from the Trump administration, and Mr. Trump in particular, he is actually signaling affection for our traditional adversaries as Russia upended the post-World War II order by destabilizing eastern Ukraine and then invading and annexing Crimea. Mr. Trump, in particular, called NATO obsolete, questioning the value of NATO, questioning the value of the European Union, notwithstanding its many bureaucratic shortcomings. This particular attitude puts Mr. Trump at odds with the conventional thinking of the majority of Republicans, whether it's on trade, on Russia, NATO. Perhaps Democrats and Republicans actually have greater shared values and interests. How do you see going forward with the Trump administration based on the rhetoric we've heard so far?
Well, I think certainly Mr. Trump has a way of speaking out that shakes a good many people who are used to more traditional means of diplomacy, to say the least. I would say that even before taking office, Donald Trump did something that no other president has ever done. He participated in a huge reception, including 200 foreign diplomats in Washington, practically on the eve of the inauguration, which the entire diplomatic community in Washington was just blown away by the attention, the grace, and the courtesy that was extended to them. So one of his first moves, even before moving into the White House, was to reach out a hand in friendship to foreign diplomats in Washington. He has made some tough comments on the need for NATO allies to pay their share, which they have committed to. Many of them have had different budget priorities and left it to the United States to defend them. I take a bit of a dim view of Russian policy myself. It is true that Vladimir Putin has twice managed to pull the wool over the eyes of U.S. presidents, the first being George W. Bush over Georgia, the second being Barack Obama, who, with the emissary of Hillary Clinton, handed him this ridiculous red button, which was supposed to set reset on it. Well, that is a childish way of trying to handle Russia relations. I hope that the Trump administration will be realistic once it sees who it's dealing with, and I hope that we will stand by the Ukrainians and all the other people in the border states along Russia. I think they have some good people in the administration, and I hope that we will remember our allies who are so important to us.
And I give the last word to Ken Good.
Well, I think the concern that we have about Trump and Russia is not that he will change his views once he learns about who Putin is. It's the concern that he knows who Putin is and has already made up his mind. And that is what I think is alarming to a lot of people here in the United States and around the world. But where I am most concerned about from the approach of the Trump administration in the medium and long term is the shift away from the post-World War II consensus in the United States of an alliance structure built on shared values and expanding that alliance structure to include more countries, which then expands the scope of the world that is living in peace, freedom, and prosperity, to a structure of interactions with other countries that is much more transactionally based, that is less about what we have as a stake in it together and more about what can you do for me now. And that leads to the kinds of comments where he says things like, every foreign leader starts on as at par for me. And that's not how the United States and that's not how the Western world has conducted foreign policy since World War II. And they don't have to just do what has come before. But if we don't do that, we are ignoring the lessons of history and recognizing that this period, this 70 plus year period since the end of World War II, has been an unprecedented era of great power peace. And what came before it was the kind of way that Donald Trump intends to conduct foreign policy of a transactional relationship with other powers. And that has traditionally always led to military conflict. And that's what I think is concerning a lot of people here in the United States and around the world about this incoming Trump administration.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of the program. I'd like to thank my guests, Hallidale, Senior Fellow in Public Diplomacy Studies at the Heritage Foundation, and Ken Good, Senior Fellow with the National Security Team at the Center for American Progress. Hella, thanks so much for your insights.
You're welcome.
And Ken, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Nelson Lopez. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
On this special...